Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Tony Mock during the June annual ASCO meeting, and to begin, I asked him about one of the most discussed lung cancer datasets presented there, a phase 3 trial in patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer and ALK tumor rearrangements. In patients who never received crizotinib, the trial randomized between crizotinib and alectinib.
So this is a Japanese study. Compare alectinib at 300 mg twice daily with the standard of crizotinib, and that is for ALK-positive patient. And so the study is actually aimed at a progression-free survival difference. And then they had approximately 115 per arm. So the study was outrageously positive with a hazard ratio of 0.34. The control arm is actually about 10.9 months, which is what you expect from crizotinib, while the median progression-free survival of the alectinib arm is actually not reached yet. So it has to be over 20 months. And so that is quite outstanding. But that is actually in line with the Japanese finding of the so-called single-arm study of alectinib, which is actually a median progression-free survival of about 26 months. And that is actually what had been happening with the Japanese data. Now, whether that is going to be translated into the same outcome in the outside Japanese country, that remains to be seen. So there's another study called the ALEC study, which is actually a bigger sample size, over 300 patients. And that study, we had already completed accrual, and now we're just waiting for the data to become mature.
So yeah, when I saw that hazard rate, I was just shocked.
It's shocking, yes and no. In a way, we know that alectinib is a more potent so-called ALK inhibitor. And second is that the CNS penetration is better. That had been reported in Ignatius Al's paper in JCO with their intracranial response rate close to 50%. And so I think a lot of the so-called progression event may actually happen in the brain, because in ALK, there's a high incidence of CNS progression coming anywhere close to 40-50%. So if you get better CNS control, you may actually win by just having a better CNS control and prevention of actual progression in the brain.
Well, that makes complete sense, because, you know, you still, either way, you see very high rate of response, crizotinib or alectinib, right?
Right.
But what you're saying is maybe more people break through with brain mets.
That is one thing. And plus, the response rates are actually higher, actually 85% versus 70%.
Yeah, really interesting. And of course, as you say, I guess survival is just really not on the table yet, too early.
Not quite, too early. Yeah.
But it would seem also better tolerated.
Much better tolerated in terms of GI toxicity, because the nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea would be less.
So are you thinking that this is now going to become first-line therapy, alectinib?
I think alectinib may become first-line eventually, but I think that we have to look in a little bit more detail before we change our mind, because the J-ALEC study is not purely a first-line study. It's a combination of first- and second-line patient, because they will have some patient with prior chemotherapy before they get randomized. So in other words, it is not a first-line study. It is just a crizotinib-naive study.
Right, got
and
it.
And then as compared to ALEC, it's a purely a first-line study.
But I mean, just last night, we had a satellite with five researchers, and all five of them were like, we're ready to give alectinib first line. But they did bring up the one thing that you mentioned, the question that this study was done in Japan and this waiting on the study in the US. And you had a really great paper in the JCO this year, Cancer Genomics, Diversity and Disparity Across Ethnicity and Geography. Mm-hmm. You could probably spend an hour talking about it. But particularly with reference to this data and this issue, how would you contrast what you might expect in Japan and, for example, North America?
Well, first of all, I think we have talked about two things. One is the basic ALK phenomenon, you know. So there are actually a slightly high incidence in the Asian population with the ALK. So the incidence could be slightly different. But one thing actually we did not know too much about are the variants. So right now we know that there are about at least 15 different variants. But whether there is actually any epidemiological difference between the variants of one population to the other, that is not too clear-cut. So would the Japanese actually have some more sensitive variant? Like the variant 1 is supposed to be more sensitive to the TKI. So those we probably have to learn a little bit more. The other is about the pharmacogenomic. At this moment, I mean, we're not aware of significant pharmacogenomic. The difference in the dosage is not pharmacogenomic. It's rather to do with the drug, with the solvent, the maximum concentration of solvent you're allowed to use in Japan. So it come a little bit interesting, you know, why we see such a phenomenal result with the Japanese population is still unknown. But that is probably likely translated going to be in the American population. Whether the degree of difference is the same or not, it remains to be seen.
So you mentioned the issue with the brain mets, and I've heard about a couple of cases of people with leptomeningeal disease responding to alectinib. I'm not sure if I've seen it in the literature, but what do we know about that?
Well, yes, there are some reported on the leptomeningeal response, but there are a couple of issues. Number one is the documentation of response is not so easy. You may have some radiological response, but very few people will have a CSF documentation of a response. So that is slightly tricky, but then a case report of such have been actually discussed and presented before.
And what's your vision in terms of why alectinib is more effective in the brain? Is it just blood-brain penetration or something else?
Yeah, I think it's actually the molecule and also the crossing the blood-brain barrier ability is higher with alectinib. And also the dosing is slightly different as well. I mean, quizartinib, due to some of the GI toxicity, you cannot really dose too high.
You know, it's interesting. It was described as being less toxic, as you say. You know, for oncologists in practice, I have 300 of them in a room, and I say, how many of you had a patient ALK disease? Like, nobody raises their hand. It's like this phantom disease, really. But in any event, you mentioned the variants of it. And I've heard some, to me, kind of scary cases of people who were FISH negative for ALK and, quote, positive for ALK when in next-gen sequencing and then responded to crizotinib. Is that true?
That is actually certainly true. Right now, we have IXC, FISH, and also PCR by sequencing. And then there are actually so discrepancy between what we call the IXC positive and FISH negative and vice versa. So the best responder are actually what we call double positive, IXC and FISH positive. And that group seem to have the best response so far. Next-gen sequencing may potentially pick up some of the cases that can be missed by FISH.
One more thing about crizotinib, you know, I kind of always had this vision. Again, oncologists, they've hardly even used the drug, but I've had this vision of being very, very well tolerated, you know, the visual things, et cetera. But how much of a problem is GI toxicity?
Oh, it's not too bad. I mean, you know, in a way is that most patients may have some degree of nausea, but never too severe. Vomiting is not too common and it's manageable in a way. But just alectinib is actually even less. That is just by comparison. This data will actually come out in the JADX study as well, the comparison of the toxicity side by side.
Interesting. Another thing I want to ask you about is a study that you did that I'm not sure really got the attention that it should have, or I mean, it just came out here, but it was the trial that compared afatinib to gefitinib up front. You know, we've always had this vision. I mean, we started to think a little bit. We started to see the afatinib data with exon 19 with the survival benefit. But can you talk about what you saw in this study?
Right. You're referring to the LuxLung 7 study, which is actually a randomized phase 2B study. I'm not a randomized phase 3, comparing afatinib at 40 milligram to gefitinib and 250 milligram. So the study was positive with progression-free survival. But I have to remind you, in this particular study, they got three co-primary endpoints, time to failure, progression-free survival and overall survival. But then in general, it's not really powered sufficiently for this three endpoint. So they do observe a difference in progression-free survival. However, the median are very similar, 10.9 versus 11. One of the reasons is that actually the first 10-9 months, actually the two survival curve, progression-free survival curve are actually overlapping. Only towards the end, you know, there's a population that seem to be doing better. And so overall, they got a positive hazard ratio. Now, whether that is going to translate into practice change is debatable. Yes, it's a positive study, but on the other hand, the difference is not huge. And due to some of the toxicity concern, you know, especially the skin rash and some of the GI toxicity and mucositis, sometimes you just have to be selective. So I have no problem using afatinib at all. However, I'm not going to say that that will replace all the first generation TKI.
So I thought the cases that you brought in here today look really great. And one that really caught my attention, you know, kind of a common, maybe not as exciting situation as some of the things we're talking about nowadays with targeted therapy and immunotherapy. But I thought it was really interesting what happened with this 68-year-old man. Can you talk about it?
Right. So this is a 68-year-old man, ex-smoker. Now, the CT scan showed left upper lobe mass, and then we confirmed there are jejunal lymph node involvement. So there's stage 3A. biopsy, EGFR negative and ALK negative. So naturally, the patient would not be eligible for any of the TKI. So the only treatment available for this gentleman would be the concurrent chemoRT. But the question is, should you give neoadjuvant treatment first or should you just go right into concurrent chemoRT?
Actually, before you get into that, you mentioned that he didn't have any targetable mutations. If he did, would you do anything? I mean, there are trials looking at upfront targeted therapy before chemo radiation. Would you do that outside of study?
Well, yes. Let me explain. Okay. So it's very tempting. I mean, come on, you got a drug that can reduce the tumor size by 70% chance and the toxicity is low. I mean, with chemotherapy, you can reduce it by about 30-40%, but then there are toxicity. So although there's no trial, but one of the reasons why there's no trial is because the number of patients with stage 3 mutation positive are very small. So actually in my practice, not this case, but in other cases, it's not uncommon I do give them neoadjuvant TKI and then I consider operation because some of the response are so dramatic. And so basically a lot of these patients with mutation positive, we give them TKI and then have the surgery.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that because I've asked, 20 U.S. lung cancer investigators. You know, they talk about the study, I forget which one it is, where they are going to test that. You know, they're going to find patients with EGFR and ALK and randomly either give them pre-chemo radiation targeted therapy or not. And I always say, well, yeah, that makes total sense. Do you do it in your practice? And they usually say, no, I only do it in the context. But I mean, as you say, you're going to make the chemo radiation less, first of all, less toxic, I would assume.
Absolutely. Now, as I stated, the ability to do a trial is very limited. I mean, the number of patients are so small with the stage 3 mutation positive that right now there's one study ongoing in China, one study ongoing in Korea. I think there's one in the United States.
Yes.
But they're not phase 3 study. Even though those data come out, they just give you some evidence that it may work, but it does not really change the practice. So I just have to adopt a little bit of common sense. If I am not doing any harm to the patient and then the chance of it responding is so high, I think it's reasonable. And in fact, I do have a number of these patients that finally get resection. And after resection, I give them chemoRT as well.
Wow, interesting. Anyhow, getting back to your case, so you had a wild type case, so to speak, without mutations. This patient presents with this stage 3A disease. What did you do?
So for this patient, actually, I decided to give a neoadjuvant pemetrexed and carboplatin. And the patient did respond well. And after that, then I gave the concurrent chemoRT. Now, one of the reasons why we do that, there's actually a couple of reasons. One is a very practical reason, is the fact that in Asia, sometimes to get a patient into radiotherapy, it takes time. And, you know, because of waiting lists and stuff like that. And, you know, while the patient is waiting, you may as well do some treatment. So that's one practical reason why I do that. And second is that I can actually minimize the radiation field as well. So this day we had IMRT, we can have tomoRT. If we can narrow down the field, the chance of having a severe pneumonitis is actually lower, relatively speaking. And so those are the two reasons why I gave the patient a neoadjuvant chemotherapy.
How well has this issue of neoadjuvant therapy in the locally advanced setting been tested in clinical trials to this point?
Well, there have been trial for the surgical resectable patient. There's a NATCH study that looked into the neoadjuvant versus surgery alone, and that showed the potential slight disease-free survival benefit. But on the stage 3, actually, there have not been too much extensive study. I think there are a Swedish study that looked into that, just reported early on in a couple of ASCO before, and then there's no office different. But as I said, I'm actually taking this approach as a more practical approach rather than there's a definitive efficacy benefit.
This patient was a smoker?
Ex-smoker, yeah.
But generally in good condition, younger patient?
Yeah.
If you could have gotten the patient in for chemo radiation immediately, would you still have done neoadjuvant?
Possibly, you know, I think either approach is acceptable to me. If the patient is ready to go and then the machine is ready, that's okay with me.
So I'm kind of surprised to see that the chemo partner you use with the radiation therapy was cisplatin. You just saw that the patient responded clinically to carbo-PEM. Why not include PEM? It's been studied in the PROCLAIM trial.
Well, that is possible. But when this happened, the PROCLAIM trial was not out yet.
I see. Okay.
So it is feasible. But I have to say that, you know, proper PROCLAIM trial is negative, relatively speaking.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Maybe you can talk about what was looked at and why you label it as negative.
Right. So the PROCLAIM trial is actually looking into the neoadjuvant pemetrexed platinum followed by concurrent versus the standard of care, which is the concurrent chemotherapy with the etoposide and platinum. Now, in a way, is that there is no difference in the overall survival. That I think that is what is defined as a negative study. However, it does demonstrate that there is less toxicity using the pemetrexed combination, and also is feasible to use the doublet in this combination. So in that case, we learned something from the PROCLAIM study. To me, the patient already received four cycle as a neoadjuvant setting. The role of chemotherapy in concurrent with RT is actually to augment the radiation effect. I'm not quite sure whether a doublet is going to be better than a single agent if I'm just looking for the augmentation effect. And as I said, this patient already got the double therapy. They do have the so-called systemic efficacy from the neoadjuvant treatment. So to minimize the local toxicity, I just stay with the single agent.
It is interesting, though, that that PROCLAIM study, a lot of people do consider it negative because there wasn't an efficacy advantage. But, I mean, even in the metastatic setting, the reason people are using pemetrexed is lack of toxicity. What kind of toxicity is less in the chemo radiation setting? And from your point of view, is it clinically significant?
Right. So the nausea and vomiting bit is less. However, there's no significant difference in terms of pneumonitis. And to us, you know, when you give concurrent chemotherapy and pneumonitis or the esophagitis are actually the more of a concern than the other systemic toxicity.
So before we go into the next case, hearing this story about this patient with getting chemo radiation therapy, obviously a common scenario. I've got to ask you another question. We had a big debate about this last night, which is obviously nowadays with checkpoint inhibitors, pretty much, I think, standard second line therapy after chemotherapy. One of the questions in my mind is, what's second line? And specifically, what about the patient who gets chemo radiation for locally advanced with early relapse, let's say before a year, or even the patient who gets adjuvant therapy in early relapse, again, 6 months to a year? How would you visualize these patients? And I don't know what the regulatory reimbursement issue is, but from a clinical point of view, should these kinds of patients be getting checkpoint inhibitors or first-line chemo?
Right. So that is a blur area, is that, you know, will you consider the management of stage three to be first line and whatever up there to be second line if it come back early enough? So I think it's a matter of definition. But then going back to the biology, if you do actually give systemic chemotherapy, just like what I did with this patient, and then patient recur within 6 months, you know that it's unlikely for the patient to be chemosensitive.
And that's a clinical occurrence.
Exactly.
You know, it's got to get big enough to, you know, it's...
Exactly. So I won't have a blank statement about this kind of situation, but I really will look at individual patient and did he really have a good response to chemotherapy, and then how quickly it recur. And then if I got a sense that the patient is unlikely going to have a benefit from further chemotherapy because the pemetrexed platinum is probably one of the better combination that we have, if they're resistant to that, then putting on another taxane-based chemotherapy is unlikely to benefit the patient as much. So those are the patients that I may discuss about the use of immunotherapy.
Huh, interesting. Hey, I'm curious about how you approach the issue of selection of checkpoint inhibitors and use of PD-L1 assays. I don't know what kind of regulatory constraints you're under. You know what's going on in the U.S. Right. What's going on with you guys?
So I actually did write an editorial for the KEYNOTE-010 study, and I actually state my point quite clearly is I don't believe the biomarker is doing a good job in selection. Right now, the overall response rate is 20%. The patient with highly expressed may have a slightly higher response rate, and then the patient with negative may have a lower response rate, but it doesn't mean that they don't respond. So, you know, in a way, is even for the patient with negative, totally negative one, their efficacy will be equal to docetaxel, but not worse than docetaxel. So what are we selecting? I mean, in a way, is that we're just selecting patients that higher versus lower, but not yes versus no. And for patient in a second-line setting, what other option do they have if they don't have a molecular target? So in a sense, is that the patient will eventually going to use it, whether you put a second line or third line. So why select it?
Let's go through again another one of your cases. Mm. This is, I think, the poster child for EGFR therapy nowadays, although I think it's changing a little bit. I'm really curious to hear what happened with this 56-year-old lady.
Right. So this 56-year lady actually present with a very typical of, you know, the right upper lobe mass with multiple pleural nodules. And certainly it is adenocarcinoma with TTF1 positive. And then it was an exon 19 positive. So obviously we put them on first line TKI. In this case, we gave gefitinib.
And I guess we should say she was a never smoker.
She was never a smoker.
Just one point though, in terms of the initial therapy here, I mean, I'm not sure exactly when, how long ago was she treated initially?
It was actually almost like two, three years ago.
Yeah. So now I'm hearing, you know, we always like to just go to investigators and say, what are you doing? You know, how do you... I'm hearing more and more people talk about using afatinib with exon 19 specifically. Are you doing that?
Not quite. Now, we are talking about the over survival benefit from the combination of Lux-Lung 3 and 6. Yeah, it's interesting phenomenon this observed in two pooled analysis. But should we change our practice based on pooled analysis of this kind is debatable. Now, look at it this way. The real randomized study is Lux-Lung 7. What if there's no over-survival benefit from Lux-Lung 7? How are you going to deal with the situation?
Because afatinib against erlotinib?
No, afatinib versus gefitinib.
Oh, the one you were just talking about.
Because over-survival data will come out anytime now. It's already mature. The data is available. It will be coming out. So if you say the pool analysis, you say that, okay, this is positive. But then in the real randomized study, there's no over-survival benefit. What are you going to do? So I think there's still a bit of cloudiness in it. And so that's fine for this reason. I think, yes, you can consider it as used, but I would not replace entirely for exon 19.
Well, maybe this will take the ALK route and maybe osimertinib will become the alectinib and slip into first line. Incidentally, do you think that's going to happen?
Osimertinib as a first line is being studied in a FURA study. And then that study is actually ongoing quite well. And then accrual is coming on very fast.
Any sense about whether you think osimertinib would be more effective and also in terms of brain mets?
Right. So there are two sets of data. One set of data is on the 60 patients who received osimertinib as a first line, was reported by Raymond Lingham in Geneva ELCC. And he reported a median progression-free survival of 19.6 months, which is quite impressive. And then the other set of data about the brain is that will be reported by James Yang in ESCO this year. And it's not a big theory, but then there will be the cases, particularly look at the CNS response. And there will be including some of the pharmacokinetic data and even CSF data.
I mean, we know that gefitinib or erlotinib can cause responses in the brain. Do you think when we look at these data, we're going to look at this and go indirectly and think that maybe this is going to be more effective in the brain, osimertinib?
So there's already some known difference between gefitinib and erlotinib in terms of CNS penetration. There are better pharmacokinetic data from erlotinib than gefitinib. Whether the osimertinib is going to be better or not, I think remain to be seen. I mean, those data, as I said, that, you know, it's not in a direct competitive setting.
So as I was saying, when I looked at this case, I said, not only is this a poster child case for lung cancer, this is a poster child case for oncology today, nowadays, which is, so first of all, she goes down the usual path. She has a great response to the gefitinib for 14 months.
Right.
How did she tolerate it, incidentally?
Perfect. I mean, living a normal life. I mean, you know.
No skin problems?
Some skin problem, but it's very manageable. A lot of these patients just got a bit of paronychiae. And so really, a lot of these patients live a very normal life for duration of time.
But then unfortunately, 14 months, she has disease progression. She has now a pleural effusion, cytology positive. And was this in the cytology fluid that you got the T790 mutation?
Well, actually, this day, there are two ways of looking into the T790M. You can either do it in the plasma or you can do it in the tissue. In her case, it's actually from the cytology
really?
Sample, we can do it. But then, you know, using the plasma test, we got actually about 70 to 80% of sensitivity.
Well, you mentioned plasma and then tumor. Then the other thing I just heard about in the last few days was urine.
Urine is feasible, but actually, if you pleural effusion is actually even better.
But the thing that kind of struck me, and again, this is being presented at ASCO. I've read the abstract. It hasn't been presented yet. Heather Wakely's presenting this as a rosalitinib study. But I thought I saw that they had patients in there. I think there were seven patients whose tissue was T790 negative and urine was positive, and they responded.
Well, definitely. I think that is the one from the urine, but then the better data is actually going to come out from the aura studies.
The serum. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And that actually was able to demonstrate, because in the aura study, there's only one data set that you have tissue, plasma, as well as the response to osimertinib.
But the thing that I had heard was that something about there aren't DNA aces in the urine. So sometimes you can have a positive urine and negative serum and tissue. Is that right?
I think you can do that. But on the other hand, a lot of this is by chance. I mean, you're talking about fragment DNA swimming around, whether they're going to catch you or not. You know, it's never going to be 100% concordance. So I won't say urine's better than the plasma or plasma better than urine. I think it's accessible, whether you can catch it or not. I doubt if you will ever have anything close to 90 or 100% sensitivity. It's probably going to stay around 80% or so. And so to me, plasma is easier to handle than the urine.
Maybe, but I mean, I guess the bottom line is there are a lot of patients where it's not that easy to get tissue. I mean, they've got bone mets, they have tissue that's tough to access. You had a pleural effusion there, but sometimes that's kind of difficult. So is the thinking that if you see a mutation, whether it's serum, urine, whatever, you're done, you've got it, but if you don't, you got to keep going?
Absolutely. So if you are plasma or urine positive, the specificity is above 90%. However, sensitivity is not that high. So even if it's negative, then you have to go to the tissue biopsy.
So the reason I say this is really a poster child for oncology is, okay, you find out she's got a T790 mutation. This must have been maybe a year or so ago, I'm going to guess.
Yep.
But you knew what you wanted her to do, but yep. The drug wasn't approved yet, which is you wanted to give her osimertinib.
Exactly. So I gave her chemotherapy because I knew that eventually I'd get that osimertinib because, you know, I've been involved with the program. And then it responded well. The effusion disappeared and keep her maintenance. And then she continued to do
it. So she had carbo-pem and then PEM maintenance?
Yeah, PEM maintenance.
Wow. Yeah. So how long was she on that?
Well, she was on it, you know, stable for 4 more cycles after maintenance. It's probably a total of about 8-9 months. And after that, her CA starts to rise again. So this is an indicator she's not going to do so well. And so by the time the Name the Patient program is available, I apply for it, and she got the drug, and she's fantastic right now.
So yeah, I say being an oncologist nowadays is you wake up in the morning, you check your phone, you see what's been approved, and then you try to figure out what you're going to do about it, you know?
That is the excitement of this time.
Anyhow, so this lady makes it through to the approval of osimertinib, gets osimertinib. What happened once she got on it?
Well, she responded, you know, and then CA dropped quite nicely and the effusion is under control and she continued to do well.
Any tolerability issues?
In her case, no. I mean, so far, my experience with osimertinib have been quite favorable. There's occasional patient with the platelet going down a little bit and there are occasional patient with a bit of hepatic toxicity, but overall, it's quite well tolerated.
So I guess the thing about these, when we first started to hear about these sort of third generation TKIs, was the lack of toxicity on normal tissue.
On the wild type.
Right, on the wild type EGFR. Right. So is that pretty much the case? You don't see diarrhea and dermatologic problems, or you do?
No, we do, but less common, less severe. So at 80 milligrams of osimertinib, we don't have too much of those problems. There are some, but not severe at all.
I mean, when I started to hear about it, the first thing I was thinking about was adjuvant. Because here you have patients, you know, in a different situation, you want to have less toxicity. I know there are adjuvant osimertinib trials going on right now. I don't know if you put any patients on them, but what would you project? I mean, could patients stay on treatment indefinitely with this, for example?
No, I think the study is targeting about 3 years, which is actually for the GIST resectable situation.
Right.
They also put patients on 3 years.
Right.
So that was the plan.
Do you see that? Do you think most patients could go through 3 years of therapy without problems?
I don't think there may be a problem, but then there is always that, you know, patients who are cured surgically of a disease, whether they want to stay on a drug for 3 years, that is still take a little bit of commitment.
So, you know, I really always liked the IMPRESS study that I think you presented that at ESMO the first time.
I presented that in ESMO.
And, you know, it was much anticipated trial. And I'd like to maybe go back through that and have you talk about the design, what you saw there. What's been seen with follow-up, which I think has been really interesting, and what you think all of it means.
Right. So in IMPRESS, you know, turnout was not too impressive. Original concept is that continuous TKI with chemotherapy up on progression may be better than chemotherapy alone, considering the fact that there may be tumor heterogeneity. So that's why we designed a study, patient who had responded for over 4 months to the TKI, and that at the time of progression, then randomize them to continuation of gefitinib with the chemotherapy or pemetrexed and carbo versus just pemetrexed carbo. We are looking for a superiority of progression-free survival, but it turned out that there's absolutely no difference in the progression-free survival. It's about 5.4 versus 5.4 months, and this already been published in Nancy Oncology by John Charles Soria, my co-PI. However, We also take the plasma at the time of enrollment to look into the T790M status. So it turned out that the patient who are T790M positive, there's absolutely no difference in the progression-free survival. But then for the patient who are T790M negative, there's a slight difference, 6.7 months versus about 5.4 months. Statistically, it's not significant. P-value is equal to 0.07, but the sample size is small because it's a subgroup analysis. So it's just a signal, but not necessarily a change of practice type of information. However, there will be something more interesting coming out in ESMO this year, is that we're going to present the overall survival data. So, you know, you should look at those overall survival data, and that might give us further idea whether we should or should not continue TKI for this group of patients.
So, you know, that also leads into the question. I was thinking about this when you were talking about your patient who had the T790 mutation in the pleural fluid, about what you would have done if the patient was T790 negative. And I'd be curious about what you think are reasonable options in that situation, how you usually manage those patients, and how does the IMPRES data relate to your decision?
At this moment, I have to be pragmatic. I still give the patient chemotherapy alone. So even though the patient T790M negative, consider our data subgroup analysis, I still have to say that those data are not convincing enough to change the practice. So I will only give chemotherapy.
So if you think about it, if they're T790 positive, hopefully they're going to go on osimertinib. Mm-hmm. If they're T790 negative, they're going to go on chemotherapy. But one of the questions that has come up from a practical point of view, and I'm not sure you could really have teased that out with the IMPRES study, is the possibility of disease flare when you pull somebody off an EGFR TKI, even though they are progressing. And I've heard people, Mark Chris is one, who says, well, what I do is I keep the TKI going until I start to see them benefiting from the chemo.
Well, that is always a debate. Personally, I don't do that. I think the number of cases of real flare-up is actually not that high. And especially, you know, if I'm going to start the patient on chemotherapy, there's a reasonable chance of disease control. So to my experience, that if I stop the TKI and put the patient on chemo, I hardly see any flare-up.
Interesting. Another choice that I'm hearing more from investigators who are saying more positive things. Initially, people were excited about cetuximab, afatinib. Then it seemed like people got, when they started to see this stuff coming out on the next generation TKIs, kind of forgot that. And now I'm hearing people talk more about that. What about afatinib, cetuximab in the patient with T790 negative disease?
I still use it from time to time. I mean, it's based on a single arm phase 2 study on 100 patients. They got a response of about 30%. The concept itself is actually what I call so-called pan-EGFR inhibition, both on the monoclonal antibody on the surface and also in the intracellular kinase. To me, that is just a very potent EGFR inhibition. It does not inhibit specific on T790M, but certainly some patients do benefit from it. I can tell you from some personal experience from another case who are exon 19 positive, did well for gefitinib for almost 2 years, progressed. I put him on afatinib plus cetuximab, and he was good for another year. And eventually he progressed, and then he turned out to be T790M positive. And wow. Now he's on osimertinib.
Wow. You know, when I first heard about cetuximab and afatinib, I thought, oh, that does not sound good for the skin. And yet I hear from investigators that somehow it's not that bad because, quote, they've already had their skin sensitized from having a TKI.
Well,
or is it really
yes
a problem?
Yes and no. I mean, I have seen some pretty bad skin toxicity, but to me, it's the dose. The U.S. actually use 500 milligram per meter square every 2 weeks. I think that's too much. And I don't think you need that much to inhibit your EGFR. So I actually use 250, which is actually more tolerable dose, you know.
So hopefully you can educate me about something that I know is important, but I'm trying to understand, which is exon 14 splice site mutations. It seems like every day we hear about a new tumor mutation in lung cancer. And I see you had this paper in Clinical Cancer Research looking at MET amplification and exon 14 splice site mutation. Is this another mutation situation that an oncologist has to be aware of for practical purposes?
Actually, this came up last year for the first time by Paul Pelec and also from the Sloan-Kettering group, that this is actually established to be a driver oncogene. However, last year, there was not too many clinical cases that was responded to crizotinib. But this year, there will be one oral presentation on this. So I don't have the data on hand yet. I'm waiting to hear those data on term of the responses of the crizotinib in management of the patient with the MET exon splicing.
But what I've heard is, quote, this is not rare. This is not an uncommon mutation.
So according to the JCO paper, it's approximately 3% of the adenocarcinoma. And then there's almost like more than 20% for patients with a sarcomatoid carcinoma of the lung.
Sarcomatoid
carcinoma of the lung, or pulmonary sarcomatoid carcinoma. And that is actually, again, is a retrospective data, but that's actually quite outstanding. So right now, actually, to me, what I do is that if the sarcomatoid, I would test for it for sure. And then for other patients, adenocarcinoma, if they are actually EGFR negative, ALK negative, then I may consider testing for it. For this, I may just share one extra case with you. This is fresh. So this is one patient of mine who actually was initially diagnosed to have EGFR exon 19 positive. Put her on TKI, no response. It was scary. So I put her on chemotherapy, no response. Scary. So I gave her radiation. And then with the radiation, we managed to control the main tumor bulk and then put her in immunotherapy. But then the immunotherapy control was very short term. And then she come up within a few months with multiple peritoneal metastases and a bowel obstruction. So we have to go in and then relieve the IO. And in the same time, we biopsy some of the tumor. We send it out. I just come back 2 days ago on my iPhone that she is MAC14, you know, skipping positive.
Wow.
And now I have not gone back to Hong Kong yet, but this is the one patient I'm going to start her on crizotinib.
Huh. And had that been tested for previously?
No.
So she might have had it all along.
She may have it all along. Because before she was EGFR mutation positive, then I did not test for anything else. I just let it be the case. But then when I do the bowel resection, the tumor was EGFR mutation negative. I say, what is going on? So I just say, no way. Let me just send it for NGS. And so I got this back.
And in terms of this exon 14 splice mutation, that gets picked up on NGS?
Yes.
Next generation sequencing
would pick it up.
Do you think that any patient with a non-squamous tumor who does not have ALK, EGFR, et cetera, should have next gen sequencing, even smokers?
That is a very interesting question. The thing is, again, go back to the risk-benefit ratio. Yes, occasionally you can pick up a case like this is outstanding. But what is the chance of picking up something that you can do something about? So in United States, where you have multiple clinical trial phase one, that basically, you know, then you can send the patient around to different trial depending on their molecular genetic study, just like the lung map study, that you can do it. But then in Asia, when we have only few phase one study, then even if you find some uncommon mutation, it's hard to locate a drug. So it becomes debatable. So we can do it, but we can only do it on selective patient in an under-selective scenario.
And in terms of, say, theoretically, what an ideal agent would be for this mutation, would it be crizotinib or would it be something else? And I've heard about alectinib.
Alectinib is one potential. And then there is another one called savontinib that's also under investigation.
So another sort of thing I've heard, sometimes I hear things, I don't know if they're based on data or whatever, but I just ask other people, is this question of what do you do after osimertinib? So for a patient that, say, goes through erlotinib, gefitinib, afatinib, then they get osimertinib, then they have disease progression. I've heard, quote, now they might respond back to the original one, right, or erlotinib, is that right?
That is a theory, because in the osimertinib failure, approximately 20% small study, that they may have a mutation called the C797S mutation. The C797 is actually the binding site of the third generation TKI. If you have a mutation there, there's no longer binding to it. So in principle, in the certain format, the trans of the C7S, they may actually, in the cell line study, respond to first generation. But that had never been proven in a clinical realm. So at this moment, we don't know. But actually, Nature just come out from last week. Pasayani's group had actually proposed a new drug that potentially can inhibit the C797S mutation.
A TKI?
It is a TKI. It's a new type of TKI, but then it's actually only some preclinical model, and then it's just a very nice paper come out the possibility of a new class of drug.
Do you think that targeted therapy alone is going to cure anybody?
See, cure is a luxury term. I mean, we live a cure life anyway. you know, we just have to make sure the patient live as long as they can with the maximum quality they can. So to me, you know, you can use the word cure, but if you live long enough and good enough, that's fine with me.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, like infections, you can get rid of them theoretically. And I almost think sometimes we have this sort of antimicrobial approach to cancer sometimes.
We are.
I kind of wonder if that really is making sense.
So for that, let me just share some of the cases that I have in Asia. I got one patient who actually had been on TKI for 9 years, and then there's no disease. Are you going to stop it? So I actually proposed to say, why don't you stop the drug and see what happened? But she said, no, she doesn't want to stop the drug.
But she's on gefitinib?
She's on gefitinib for 9 years. And then she just doesn't want to stop the drug. And because, you know, that is one thing that keep her alive, that's what she thought. But so, you know, is she cured now that she lived 9 years and there's no detectable disease?
We were talking earlier about patients who experience disease progression on EGFR TKIs. What are your thoughts about treating these patients with combination checkpoint inhibitors and targeted therapy?
There are two issues. One is that on the combination, there are potential increased toxicity. The TATEN study, osimertinib with durvalumab, they have actually almost like 30% chance of ILD. So that is not quite acceptable.
Interstitial lung disease.
Interstitial lung disease. And then the other thing is this, that we have to understand the fact that so far, in the EGFR subgroup and ALK subgroup, the response rate to the immunotherapy is not that high. You saw that in Justin Gaynor's data.
Specifically also, in patients with mutations,
exactly,
they're non-smokers.
They're non-smokers, they don't have a high response rate. So it's a little bit of wishful thinking that, okay, this drug is good, I add on another one and make it better. That's still wishful thinking with no evidence to support that it would change the paradigm.
So the final thing I want to ask you about is sort of the ultimate driver mutation, which has been so discouraging, which is KRAS. I mean, that's like 25%, right?
Right,
it's like
right,
huge.
Right,
it's like right. A huge gorilla in the room, so to speak.
Right. I think that's the two things. I think KRAS mutation is number one, by nature of the mutation, is a tough mutation to beat. And number two is a lot of KRAS mutations are heavy smokers as well. And they do have other genes. So KRAS is one of them, but then they do have other oncogenic processes ongoing. So even though you inhibit so-called the KRAS trend, doesn't mean that the patient is going to rely completely on the KRAS.
So the patients are KRAS positive, they have, quote, high mutational load in general?
Because most of them are heavy smoker. And then so they do have other, you know, mutation apart from the KRAS. Unlike the non-smoker with the EGFR, basically the mutation load is a lot lower for this group of patients.